Welcome to Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams. I'm your host, Stacey Abrams. And today I am delighted and honored to welcome a guest to the show for a very special bonus episode, Vice President Kamala Harris. Vice President Harris, it is such a treat to be with you today.
And you, Madam Stacey Abrams, it's a treat to be with you.
So before we jump into the harder stuff, I want to start talking about people. As you know, I launched this project called the 10 Steps Campaign, which is really focused on how do we think about authoritarianism and democracy. Mm-hmm. But one of the joys of this project has been talking to young people. Yeah. And I know you have kids and niece. Yeah. I've got six nieces and nephews. And a week ago, we had 68 young people from across the country, a very healthy representation from California, that just covered the spectrum. And what was so extraordinary was hearing them talk about their hopes for not just America, but for themselves. Like, they're young enough to still think anything they imagine is possible. And I'd love for you to start us off by talking about the young people that you've been engaging with and seeing, whether they're the ones who live with you or live near you or the ones you're seeing out on the road.
Well, so it could be our kids. It could be my godchildren, you know, and that so that category ranges from millennials to Gen Z. And then my baby nieces, who are Gen Alpha, who also have things to say. And you're right. I mean, the thing that I love about that whole cohort is they are not sitting around waiting for somebody to give them permission to have an opinion or to lead. And the other thing that I'm finding as a general matter is they are so beautifully impatient. Like, you know, I mean, they're not going to, they're not sitting around waiting for us to figure it out. And I think it, part of it is because they know that there's so much at stake for them. And therein, I think, lies the optimism for them, because they do feel their power. And, you know, when I think, I feel strongly that when you feel powerless, you will be powerless. And when you feel powerful, you will be powerful. And that's what I'm seeing from them. And then in my travels, I mean, I one group that I met with students at North Carolina A&T who are organizing around voting rights, because, of course, those officials in North Carolina took the, Stacey, took the polling place off their campus. North Carolina A&T is the largest HBCU in the country. And these people took the polling place from these young leaders at a stage of the student's life when you want that they're going to have habits that are good for the rest of their adult life, including voting. And I met with these young leaders, these students who are organizing around this. And I'm going to tell you, they are about the business. They went up to the Capitol and interestingly enough, they told me about how when they were at the Capitol, the leader in the chamber said to them, "You have 5 minutes to leave." And so this is how they're being treated, and they are not deterred. So they're organizing, they're raising money for buses to take the students then to the polling places at election time. And you know, they're reaching out to people like me and others. Because they are insisting that they be heard and that everyone understands what is at stake for them. And that gives me so much inspiration and hope, right?
Well, I think it's emblematic of both the challenge and the opportunity. You know, I'm from the South. I grew up in Mississippi, came of age in Georgia. And I know you've been spending a lot of time in the South recently. Yeah. You've been to Tennessee and Louisiana and North Carolina. And what I tell people when they want to understand what authoritarianism can look like in the U.S., I say, look south. We have lived under soft authoritarianism, I would say, since 1776. And what it has meant is that we have seen the warning signs long before the rest of the country. but we've also been the architects of the solutions long before the rest of the country understands it. And when you talk about what's happening in North Carolina, I liken it to the fact that we are having this false debate about voter ID. Every state requires that you identify who you are. But if you're in Texas, you can use your gun license and not your student ID. If you're in North Carolina, yeah, you can vote if you can manage to get to a polling place where you know a lot of students don't actually have cars. They don't have the ability to do so. And North Carolina.
And the gas prices have been jacked up because of this war nobody wants.
Exactly. And so I'd love for you to talk about not only what you're seeing from students, but what you are hearing from people when, because a lot of what we do on the show is not just articulate the problem, but really talk about how people are meeting the moment.
And experiencing it, right.
Yeah. And I would love for you to just share a little bit about what you're seeing. If you can give us one moment of highlight and one moment where you felt the challenge of it, but you are still believing that there's something we can do.
Well, to your point, most recently, last week, I was in Louisiana, and in Louisiana, of course, is ground zero on the Calais decision, which now has been probably the final and fatal blow to the Voting Rights Act. And the case, of course, as you know, is Louisiana v. Calais. And what they've been doing in Louisiana, as they've been doing in many other southern states, to your point, is redrawing the lines and essentially cheating. But what I found in Louisiana most recently, and in many of these southern states where I've been spending time, is one, it is not a new experience in the history of, in particular, Black folks in those states, as you have pointed out. And so there is some level of muscle memory about the fight, the obstacles that will intentionally be thrown in people's way, and the need to fight against those obstacles and jump around those obstacles. And so, for example, the Louisiana Democratic Party has been doing this whole ground operation. They went to, like, I don't know, I think it was like 23 cities in a defined number of days to start working on the grassroots, you know, neighbor to neighbor approach, to remind people of not only the significance of their right to vote, but how people are trying to take it away from them. And what I'm seeing is the fight, and the fight being for something, not against something. Right. The fight for the power of the people, the fight for the rights of the people, the fight for the voice of the people. But I'm also seeing, Stacey, I mean, folks are angry. You know, they're pissed. And that can often be an important motivator for action. I would caution us, though, that I don't believe that is, we should assume that that anger will result in action in terms of voting.
Right.
And so I feel very strongly we have got to put the resources into those southern states to support those local leaders who are doing the work on the ground to remind the people of their power.
Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by Blissey. I've worn my hair natural for years, which makes taking care of it at night even more important. That's why I turned to Blissey to help protect my curls. Blissey's silk pillowcases are even better than satin. They're natural, cooling, and gentler on your skin and hair. Silk helps reduce frizz and breakage while helping preserve your hairstyle and color. Blissey uses the highest quality silk, which is 6A grade, 100% pure mulberry silk. They're also easy to care for because they're fully machine washable. The pillowcases come in more than 100 colors and fun designs to suit every personality. I like that I can choose different ones to match my various sheet sets. It's no surprise Blissey has sold more than 3 million pillowcases and has been featured in Vogue, Oprah Daily, and Good Morning America. Look, I like them so much that I pack one in my suitcase every time I travel. If you're looking for a gift that won't need a return receipt, try Blissey. You can also get matching sleep masks, bonnets, and crease-preventing scrunchies. Because you're a listener, Blissey is offering 60 nights risk-free plus an additional 30% off when you shop at blissey.com/assembly. That's B-L-I-S-S-Y skinclean.com/assembly and use code assembly to get an additional 30% off. Your skin and hair will thank you. Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by Built. Housing has always been one of life's biggest expenses. Whether you're paying rent or a mortgage, it's a payment you're going to make every month. Here's a question. Are you getting rewarded for paying your rent or mortgage right now? If the answer is no, you need to check out Built. Becoming a Built member means earning points on every housing payment, no matter where you live. And those Built points can be redeemed towards flights, hotels, Lyft rides, Amazon.com purchases, future housing payments, fitness classes, and more. Personally, I'd probably put my points towards travel or a great meal at one of Built's restaurant partners. One feature I think is especially interesting is Built's neighborhood concierge. We hear a lot about agentic AI these days, but this is a practical example of what that can actually look like. Instead of giving you just recommendations, the neighborhood concierge can help get things done. It can make a dinner reservation, book a fitness class, schedule a Lyft ride, and point you toward exclusive member benefits at restaurants and businesses around your neighborhood. Getting started is simple. First, download the Built app. Then link any credit card or debit card so purchases at your favorite local spots become even more rewarding. Finally, ask the neighborhood concierge just about anything and let it help you take care of the details. And for the homeowners listening, Built works for mortgages too. If you're already making a housing payment every month, it's worth taking a look. Download the Built app and join the membership for where you live at joinbuilt.com/assembly. That's joinbuilt.com/assembly. And use our link so they know we sent you. I spend a lot of time, I appreciate you saying that, because I spend a lot of time talking to people who are not from the South, mm-hmm. who hear about the work that I've done here, you know the work that's being done mm-hmm. across the South and think, oh, how nice. Like, that's so cute what you're doing. Not cute, but mm-hmm. there is a dismissal sometimes that this is a Southern problem. And
right.
our argument is what they practice down here, they apply everywhere else.
That's right.
And I'd love for you to talk about why this is a national responsibility, that the money coming to the South is in service of everyone and not simply yeah. about winning some seats in the South or pushing back in the South.
Well, let me just start by thanking you, because you have created a model for many states and for those from a national level who are looking at how you can organize within a state. You have created an effective model that has obviously you are, you know, the wins that we've seen in the state of Georgia. I look at the work that you did over and have continued to do over many years as paving the path for the wins that we've seen in Georgia. So I want to just start by thanking you, Stacey, for what you do and what you have done. You know, I think part of the problem is there is a misperception and maybe even a lack of understanding that we have a lot of people in the South who, even if they're in so-called red states, when they activate, when they vote, can make a difference, not only for the people of those states, but have national impact. And so I think part of the problem, just speaking very candidly, is at a national level, when Democrats have just basically said, oh, that's nice if you want to do some work in the South, but basically we can't win the South, therefore we will not put the resources into it. That's a huge mistake for a number of reasons.
Again. just so we can clip that part. Just say it one more time.
That's a huge mistake.
Thank you.
And including what you know. I mean, we are seeing, if you just look at changing demographics in the country, we're seeing this whole reverse migration, in particular of young Black families going back to the South, white families, Asian, like we are Latino, people moving to the South for a variety of reasons, including cost of living, including, you know, a lot of the topography in the southern states. It's very attractive for people to live.
Yeah.
So people are going there, and people are there. And if we're going to be a party that cares about all the people, we have to put the resources into speaking with them. And most importantly, first and foremost, listening. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. I have been spending a lot of time traveling around our country in the last year and meeting with folks on the ground, with all due respect, not meeting with elected leaders, but meeting with folks. And I was in Jackson, Mississippi, and I visited with this nonprofit that is helping the parents in that community buy uniforms for their kids and give them counseling and support. I met this woman and I ended up grocery shopping with her. Stacy, she is a mother of three children. She likes to do hair, but she needs to get a license so she can charge what she is due and the value of her work. So she's putting herself through cosmetology school. And she has a family food budget for the four of them of $150 a week. Yeah. And so I went grocery shopping with her. We went to the discount grocery store. She's buying, putting stuff in the cart. At one point I asked her, well, what in the cart is for you? And that was the only time this woman with incredible dignity broke down crying, saying, well, she'll eat whatever the kids don't eat.
Right.
We went to then the aisle where the beverages are, and she got this big pallet of bottled water because, as she explained, the water that comes out the pipe is brown.
Yep.
Sometimes it's so bad she cannot bathe her children in that water. Now, this is America, right? And there are people who live in America, including this lady and her children in Jackson, Mississippi, who deserve to be seen and heard, with whose stories deserve to be lifted up. So when we are talking about how we will create national policy, we have her in mind as much as anybody in a so-called blue state or other region of the country. And so when I think about the South, it's also about the reciprocal nature of relationships, and that you can't just want something from the people without also giving them a reason to believe that there is an option and that things can change. And if we don't put the resources into the Southern states, then, you know, things may not change. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I really appreciate you using that story as emblematic, because when I think about the conversation that we're having nationally about democracy, mm-hmm. my frustration is that we talk about it in this esoteric remove from people's lived experiences. But as you just pointed out, Jackson, Mississippi, that's the capital city for the state of Mississippi.
Yeah.
And there's going to be someone who hears this and says, well, it's run by a Democrat. But it's a state that's run by Republicans who are the intercessors of the resources that get spent.
Absolutely right.
And we've seen this happen in Detroit, but we've also seen this happen in red states with fairly homogenous populations where
that's
they
right.
also don't have water.
That's
and
right.
the issue is not a question of who gets clean water. It's why is that a conversation in 2026 in the United States of America?
That's right.
And if you solve that problem in Mississippi, you have a template for how you solve that problem in Kansas, in Idaho, and in
That's
Detroit.
Right.
And
right.
so one of the things that mm-hmm. you and I have talked about a lot is, you know, our shared lineage coming from parents who understand that mm-hmm. social justice and civil rights advocacy are some of the highest examples of patriotism, that democracy demands that we solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
And when I listen to you talk about your travels, I would love for you to talk a bit about how your, parental history really impacts the way you think about the fight against this, competitive authoritarianism that we're facing in this country.
Right. Well, to your point, we have a shared lineage in that way. My parents were active in the civil rights movement. As I often describe, they spent full time marching and shouting for justice, pushing me in a stroller. And, I think about one, it was being raised in that environment. Every message that I was sent in through all of the senses made clear you have to fight for your rights. the movement also was reinforced the point that these are innate rights, which will not be given because it is no one to give. It is your right. And so it's about reinforcing your rights as opposed to asking for privileges that are, you know, special when in fact it's the right of all people in our country. You know, I think about, you know, there's a saying from Coretta Scott King, I'll paraphrase, but that the fight for civil rights must be fought and won with each generation. And the point there being that whatever gains are made, they're not going to be permanent unless we are vigilant. So when I think about my parents' activism, there was a lot of the leaders of that moment that were also reminding all of us that this each generation has a responsibility and a duty to reinforce and defend and uphold the rights. And, you know, and now we're obviously in a place where, especially the Cali decision being the most recent example, where they are not only rolling back these rights, they have essentially with the Cali decision backdoored racism through an argument about politics and have essentially reinstated a Jim Crow system in America. And so everything that I learned growing up was one, frankly, to not be surprised that there will be those attacks, but to be vigilant and not be dispirited and not give up.
I recently lost my father.
I want to say
thank you to you for just the lovely, lovely tribute that you wrote about my dad. But I raised him because the day the Cali decision came out, my dad was in the hospital. He was, it was, you know, April 29th. We were going to lose him a few months later. And he was having challenges. And my mom had been in the hospital with him by his side. They'd been together since, my parents had been together since they were 16. 59 years. I'm not sure she liked him the whole time, but, you know.
But they endured.
Exactly. And when I went to go and visit my parents, my dad was laying in this hospital bed and I was like, "Daddy, how are you doing?" And he said, "Not good." And I looked at my mom to find out what was happening. He's like, "What is this Calais decision? What are you going to do about this?" And I'm like, "Daddy, I'm not in charge of voting rights in America. I don't know what you mean. What am I going to do about it?" And when I said that, you know, he and my mother both laughed and they said, "Yes, you are. This is your job." Yeah. And I think that you know, for my parents, for your parents, here with us still or watching us from above, there's this sense of obligation that we have.
That's right.
And while we may call it civil rights or while it may harken back to Jim Crow, it fundamentally comes back to the question of who has the right to prosperity in this country, who has the right to participation in this country.
And freedom.
And when I think about the conversations of freedom, I necessarily come back around to a conversation of who has the right to be here. And a lot of the narration that we're hearing from authoritarians is this question of who gets to be here. You mentioned the numbers in the South. 60% of Black people live in the South. So 60% of Black people in America live in the South.
Right.
40%+ of Latinos live in the South.
Right.
22% of the AAPI population lives in the South. 20% of the Native American population lives in the South. And yet we're still arguing over who gets to be here. And as someone who blends so well, so much of that history of genealogy and the conversation about race, how do you respond to those who would argue that we shouldn't be talking about racial identity as a part and a proxy of our democracy? Because what I learned from my parents, what my dad said that night, was that they were coming after Black folks to start, but they weren't going to stop with us. And that's therefore, right. There has to be this larger lens that we have when we talk about civil rights in the 21st century.
Right. And I think that is as long as we recognize and are honest about how race impacts decisions that are being made, we can't not talk about what we need to do to confront racism and policies that have a disproportionate and often intentional impact on certain populations of people based on race. And, you know, I mean, I think that part of the pain of this moment, Stacey, is these so-called leaders who are pushing this kind of this narrative about who is a legitimate American citizen among American citizens. Yeah. This blood and soil narrative that's being pushed at the highest levels of our government to suggest that, you know, once again, to harken back to times when it was explicit that there was a hierarchy among Americans and who was superior and whom was inferior, all citizens. And that's what's happening right now. And so even among American citizens, pushing this hierarchy around status and who therefore is deserving of and entitled to the full rights and protections of an American citizen. It's extraordinary to watch what is happening. And then, of course, there is what is happening around, you know, this idea about the other. And, you know, I thought to some extent maybe we would, I don't know, not get past it, because we never did get past it. But I thought that it was starting, that we were starting to embrace a bit more the fallacy of arguments that try to suggest that people who don't look like you are inferior to you. But what we have right now is overt racism in America by some. And what's interesting is they are pushing it to also suggest to others that even though you can't afford your gas, even though you can't afford your rent, even though you can't afford your health care, you are superior to other people. So you're going to be okay. And remember, this is exactly what happened after the Civil War with Jim Crow laws, where you had white sharecroppers and black sharecroppers in many situations, you know, struggling similarly on the economic piece. But then the messaging went out, well, but at least you're superior to those black sharecroppers, right, from a hierarchical perspective around who is entitled to more rights as an American.
Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by bookshop.org. Would you be surprised to learn that we're living in a resurgence of independent bookstores? More than 1,000 new stores have opened in the last 5 years. Independent bookstores do more than sell books. They take care of and pour back into their communities, creating safe spaces that foster culture, curiosity, and yes, a love of reading. When you purchase from bookshop.org, you're supporting more than 3,000 local independent bookstores so they can continue their essential work. Because I like to read both fiction and nonfiction, right now I'm reading All the Sinners Bleed by S.A. Cosby, and it's great. Use code ASSEMBLY to get 10% off your next order at bookshop.org. That's 10% off at bookshop.org with code ASSEMBLY. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but one thing we haven't really talked about is how much people appreciate the service after they use it. If you're curious, you don't have to take my word for it. You can visit betterhelp.com/reviews and see real customer feedback that's updated every day with hundreds of people sharing their experiences. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on more than 1.7 million client session reviews. More than 6 million people around the world have already used BetterHelp, and the feedback from people who've actually used the services speaks for itself. BetterHelp therapists have at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of hands-on experience, along with the education, training, and certifications required across a range of mental health specialties. Getting started is straightforward. Answer a few questions, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, and if it doesn't feel like the right fit, you can switch therapist at any time. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com/Abrams. That's betterhelp.com/Abrams.
It's such a distraction, to your point. Your superiority is not going to put more food on your table.
Because
they're not going to pay you for your superiority. They're not going to pay you for the reinforcement of oppression across communities. And you know, you and I are both lawyers by training. We also know that the laws of this nation, some of them are bound to our citizenship, but a number of them are bound to our humanity and our presence in this country.
Yeah.
And we have seen this administration, this regime, issue a sweeping crackdown on immigrants, from the aggressive ICE raids, the efforts to restrict birthright citizenship, the children who are held in prison camps in this country. I was down in Dilley, Texas. We have a program that we call Read Them Home, where we are reading them bedtime stories in absentia because there are children in this country who do not have access to the basic perquisites of childhood. We've had at least 22 people who've died while in ICE custody this year alone. And when we think about what the Constitution demands, how are you processing what not just this administration, but every lawmaker who has suborned that behavior, how are you processing what they're doing? And what do you believe Democrats should be doing differently to protect not just immigrant communities, but to respond to these policies?
Part of it is, and this may seem simplistic, but I think it is, it can be a compelling approach. We have to keep telling the stories as you just did. So in my travels, it included meeting with a woman who is documented. Her husband is not. Her children were born in the United States. And she lives within and among other immigrant families and blended families, right? So some members of the family are documented, some are not. And she was describing to me how traditionally a lot of immigrants would move into this one housing complex. And now it has a very high vacancy rate because those families are afraid to be where ICE will then conduct its full-scale raids. So these families are now renting basements, in many cases, unfinished basements, to be scattered around the community so they cannot be sitting duck in one place where then these ICE raids are happening. And they're paying exorbitant rent for these, you know, inhumane conditions, basically, for fear of being arrested, even when they have not, you know, they're not criminals, as this administration said it was only going to prioritize, right? But Stacey, the stories that she shared with me include that the women of the community, that there are women in the community who will not go to the hospital to give birth because they are so afraid that after giving birth, the child will be taken from them. Think about that. And, you know, listen, we have to have immigration laws. We need to have a secure border. We need to put resources into making sure our border is secure. We also must be humane in the way that we enforce our laws. And the kinds of stories that you just shared, the stories I've heard, are not a reflection of a humane system. And I actually think that the visual images that have, less so recently, but been shown by mainstream media have had an impact on how Americans writ large feel about the brutal policies of this administration as it relates to immigration enforcement. But, you know, I'll say that, but I'll also, if I could segue to a related point, what I'm also hearing and from folks out there is I think that we are not being as compelling in our arguments when we talk about the need to protect democracy and the need to protect the rule of law. Because the way it is landing for many people is we're the party of wanting to protect status quo. Yeah. or we're the party that wants to protect a legal system that is unequal in its application and treatment of the people. And I think there's some work to be done to be more articulate about how we describe the rights that a democracy will protect and enforce in a way that we're not talking about a system as though we want to defend a system, when I think you can see through many of the recent elections, people are done with status quo and are not interested in a defense of status quo.
Absolutely. I mean, the way I talk about this, I was in Houston and Maine and Chicago, New York. I spend some time in Georgia, which is where I live, but I'm traveling a lot. And when I talk about it, part of, and I think this is what you're raising, for the average person who cares about this country, democracy has become this esoteric defense against action. Like, we just defend democracy. We don't have to actually do anything about it.
Right.
And, you know, when I describe what we're facing, like competitive authoritarianism, people have power. So authoritarians want to steal your power from you. They want to hoard that power to themselves and their friends. And then they never want to be held accountable for that power.
That's right.
Democracy is the antidote. Democracy is, we got to share that power. We all have some and we decide we're going to share it amongst each other. Right. We're not going to always like what we get, but we know that we get more when we decide to share it. Mm-hmm. Two, we have to leverage that power for the benefit of others, even people we don't like.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, we have to be held accountable for what we do with that power, which is why we have elections, why we have the rule of law. But all of those are tactical. And what you are describing is the strategic imperative of democracy.
Right.
People have to see democracy do something. Right. Otherwise, it's just one more person telling them why they can't have what they need. And so when you're thinking about the elections that we're watching right now, before the conversation started, we were talking about last night's results, and we're having this conversation on Wednesday. And you said it was about reading the tea leaves. And I'm like, yeah, but we're looking at coffee beans. we keep trying to.
Okay, unpack that.
I will.
Unpack that for a minute. I drink tea. My husband drinks coffee. Just tell me what to do with the coffee tea thing.
So when you're reading the tea leaves, if you think about the tea leaf notion, it's that, you know, embedded, once you drink the tea and you pour the leaves out.
Yeah. Right, those like the Turkish,
exactly. When they're searching for what it's telling you, you're looking at the leaves and their vein. I don't know what they're looking at. It just looks really cool if you're doing
a movie. Yeah, it is.
And my point is, for those of us who drink tea like you and me, if you're looking at coffee beans and trying to do what a tea leaf is supposed to tell you, it's apples and oranges.
Right.
And instead of us trying our best to discern something from the scattered approach, instead, there's a different conversation we should be having, which is, what are people asking for? And why are we trying to determine it based on one set of metrics? And so I would love for you to talk about, like, what do you think voters are telling us? Not necessarily through the tea leaves or the coffee beans, and I'm going to abandon this analogy now, but what do you think voters are telling us because of the moment that we're in?
I'll distinguish the question you presented from a conversation I think is happening a lot right now, which is, you know, what is the future of the Democratic Party? Where is it headed? Because I think it's too early to tell based on just a collection of recent elections. But I will say that I think that what we are seeing is, again, there is almost a rebellion against status quo, because it has not been working for a lot of people for a long time. The way I think and talk about it is, you know, for a lot of people, the American dream has become an American myth. And so what I think we must do is, to your point, get back down to some of the basics around how we ensure that the actual needs of the people are being met, not through rhetoric, but through the work and action that is necessary. And, you know, top of the list, of course, is affordability. And it is, you know, three main areas that people talk about and are experiencing, which is, it's going to be about the affordability of housing, healthcare, and childcare. right? I mean, in places, there are places in our country where childcare is more expensive than rent.
Yeah.
And at the very least, the second highest expense they have in their budget. And so the point then being where I think if we were looking at a Venn diagram where there is an intersection among voters, however they're voting, it is around the need for those core issues to be addressed and who and how they believe it is most likely to occur, by whom and how. And I think that's going to be one of the main motivators for people to vote and to decide who they vote for.
Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by Quince. Does anyone else feel like August is the Sunday of summer? It's the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush. And for me, that starts with looking at my wardrobe and looking around my house. Quince proves that you don't need a crowded closet to look incredible. You just need the right pieces. Quince specializes in effortless, high-quality essentials like ultra-soft organic cotton and premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters. They're beautifully tailored, built to last, and transition seamlessly from morning meetings to dinner. Their premium stretch denim starts at just $50 with the kind of fit, structure, and quality you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. One thing I appreciate about Quince is having pieces I can reach for again and again because they work for so many different occasions. Those are the kinds of wardrobe staples that earn their place in your closet. And it's not just apparel. Quince also brings that same everyday elevation to everything they offer, from hotel quality bedding and bath to kitchen essentials and thoughtfully designed furniture. So upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/Stacey for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/Stacey for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/Stacey.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to ask you to expand on that a little bit because we have had a lot of conversations on this podcast about the structural reforms that are necessary.
Yeah.
I push back against this idea that we just have to fix some of the structures and we'll be fine. If we just put better people here, it'll get better. Because I think what we have has been fundamentally broken by the willingness of not just this regime, but several regimes that preceded it. It's insufficient for us to think if we win the midterms, if we win in 28, then all we have to do is go back to what we had and just be better about it. And what I hear you saying is that if we don't have real policies that help, but even policies sound insufficient. When you think about what this moment requires, when we want people to move from myth back to dream when it comes to America, what do you bring in from your experiences? If you've got a couple of minutes to tell someone, here's why you should hold on and here's what you should demand, what does that sound like?
Well, to your point about structural change, I think we need to revisit the efficacy of the Electoral College. I think we need to expand the Supreme Court and look at reforms. you know, so much of what we are dealing with right now, back to the point of just a violation of civil rights and all that your parents and mine fought for, the Supreme Court decisions by this court that was basically at this point hand selected by Donald Trump, it should include what we need to do to look at, okay, this is going to be very specific, but when we regain power in the Senate through Senate Judiciary, getting real tough with nominees who we know are lying and hold them in contempt. And through that committee, passing the rules that it can pass without the whole Senate to hold federal judges and Supreme Court justices, to your point about accountability, accountable to the truth. I think that, you know, Stacey, I'll tell you, I think we've got to be ruthless. And by that, I don't mean the way they are. It's not cruel, but we have to be uncompromising. And we have to understand that we're going to have to toughen up a bit around really being focused on results and not sitting around waiting for Republicans to have an epiphany. Because, you know, people's rent can't wait for that. People's healthcare affordability can't wait for that. Being able to afford childcare can't wait for that. And so, you know, I think there are some things that we need to do that are just about our attitude about these things. You know, when I was growing up, oh, you got an attitude? Well, actually, I am advocating for having an attitude.
Well, look, in the South, we call it being nice nasty, and I think to your point, part of our responsibility in this moment, not just waiting until we have power, but how we gain this power back for the people, is grounded in this responsibility to be ruthless, to say that we will not compromise on your humanity just because it's an inconvenient
truth. Or that it will involve some tension, or it will it might. You know, there might be some friendships that are on the line around, you know, this, I don't know, nostalgia about how you work together to grow and build consensus. The people can't wait for that when it comes to these essential needs. They just can't.
As Vice President, as a U.S. Senator, you understood that you could compromise on behavior, meaning we could negotiate things, but you were never going to compromise your values.
And principles, and exactly, and morals. You're exactly right. I mean, compromise is good, but not compromise of those exact points, of your values and your principles. And also, you know this, but when you take an oath to hold elected office, you work on behalf of the people in the public trust. That's what you hold, the public trust. And so the job and responsibility is not to be about looking in the mirror, it's looking at the people.
Yes.
And are you delivering what they have a right to expect of their government?
I could not have said it better myself. And therefore, I'm going to ask you to do something we ask every one of our guests here at Assembly Required to do.
Okay.
We ask our guests to give people homework. We want our audience to be able to make a difference. So if you can give our members one piece of advice or one action step they should take on how to get involved, how to be ruthless within the, you know, parameters of their experience, what would you recommend they do?
Oh, I got so many things, but I'll start with this thematically, perhaps.
Okay.
I would ask your listeners to get back to that good old neighbor-to-neighbor approach around organizing and empowering and empowerment. And by that, I mean getting involved in the local nonprofit who, you know, so many of our nonprofits have been, their federal, you know, stipends have been wiped out by this administration. And they're just stretched because there's such a need for services and support. So, you know, if you've got one day a month that you can go volunteer, or you've got $10 you can spare, reaching out to those nonprofits, it will be godsend for them. It includes obviously getting involved in campaigns, getting active in voter registration, but that good old fashioned neighbor to neighbor approach. And it includes, by the way, Stacey, you know, if you're going to do a Costco run and you know you have a neighbor, maybe a single father, a single mother, and just calling them up and saying, hey, I'm going to do a Costco run. Can I pick something up for you?
Exactly.
I think people are feeling, in many places, for understandable reasons, a sense of hopelessness, and people are feeling alone. And each of us has a profound amount of power to lift up the spirits of the people in our own lives, in our neighborhood, in our community. And I'd ask your listeners to just really know that that is an immense amount of power that you have, and it will make a difference, even if we just, each of us, do it just one neighbor to the next.
Vice President Kamala Harris, thank you so much for taking time to join us here on Assembly Required and for making my day.
Thank you. You made my day. Stacey, thank you for everything you do. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
As always at Assembly Required, we give you actionable tools to help you make a difference. So first, let's be curious. Sometimes it feels like we are overloaded with information, have a million articles open in tabs, and we just don't know where to begin. So in addition to what we heard from Madam Vice President, your additional homework today is to pick one of those tabs, one of those articles that piques your curiosity and actually sit down to read it. And with news and reading on the decline, if you haven't already subscribed to support your local newspaper, please consider doing so. And because this is a bonus episode, I'm going to give you a bonus step one, which is the 10 Steps campaign works with partner organizations across the country dedicated to uplifting their communities. And I would like for each of you to take the opportunity to support their excellent work. And so if you will visit 10stepscampaign.org, you will find organizations near you, near to your geographic location and near to your heart. Go to 10stepscampaign.org, find out what kind of democracy defender you are, and get connected to organizations who can help you do even more. Number two, we need to solve some problems. Run for Something Civics is a nonprofit organization that encourages young people to step up and run for office, and it helps support them with free future candidates courses. So visit runforsomethingcivics.net to sign up for a training or to donate. And number three, let's do some good. Above All is an organization dedicated to building a world where abortion care is affordable, available, and supported for everyone who needs it. So please visit aboveall.org to learn more about their work and donate. That wraps up this episode of Assembly Required, a special conversation with Vice President Kamala Harris. Thank you for joining us, and I'll see you next week.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.